Chapter 30. Pitt swung his rented minicar off the state thruway and entered a narrow paved road adjoining the Hudson River shortly after sunset. He passed a stone marker designating a Revolutionary War site and was tempted to stop and stretch his legs, but decided to press on to his destination before it became dark. The scenic river was beautiful in the fading light. The fields that dipped to the water's edge glistened under a late winter snowfall. He stopped for gas at a small station below the town of Coxsackie. The attendant, an elderly man in faded coveralls, stayed inside the office, his feet propped on a metal stool in front of a wood-burning stove. Pitt filled the tank and entered. The attendant peered around him at the pump. "Looks like $20 even," he said. Pitt handed him the cash. "How much further to Wackature?" His eyes squinted in suspicion as they studied Pitt like probes. "Wackature? It ain't been called that in years. Fact of the matter is, the town don't exist no more." "A ghost town in upstate New York? I'd have thought the Southwest Desert a more likely place." "No joke, mister. When the railroad line was torn up back in 49, Wackature gave up and died. Most of the buildings were burned down by vandals. Nobody lives there anymore except some fellow who makes statues."
"Is anything left of the old track bed?" Pitt asked.
"Most of it's gone," said the old man, his expression turning wistful. "Damn shame, too." Then he shrugged. "At least we didn't have to see them smelly diesels come through here. The last train over the old line was pulled by steam."
"Perhaps steam will return some day."
"I'll never live to see it."
The attendant looked at Pitt with growing respect.
"How come you're interested in a deserted railroad?"
"I'm a train nut," Pitt lied without hesitation. He seemed to be getting quite good at it lately. "My special interest is the classic trains. At the moment, I'm researching the Manhattan Limited of the New York and Quebec Northern system."
"That's the one that fell through the Deauville Bridge. Killed 100 people, you know."
"Yes," Pitt said evenly, "I know."
The old man turned and gazed out the window. "The Manhattan Limited is special," he said. "You can always tell when it comes down the line. It has a sound all its own."
Pitt wasn't sure he heard right. The attendant was speaking in the present tense.
"You must be talking about a different train."
"No, sir. I've watched the old Manhattan Limited come hootin' and clankin' down the track, whistle a-blowin', headlight a-glowin', just like it did the night it went in the river."
The old-timer spoke of seeing the phantom train as nonchalantly as if he were describing the weather. It was dusk when Pitt stopped his car at a small turnout in the road. A cold wind was rolling in from the north, and he zipped an old leather driving jacket to his neck and turned up the collar. He slipped a knit ski cap over his head and stepped out of the car, locking the doors. The colors in the western sky were altering from orange to a blue-purple as he trudged across a frozen field toward the river, his boots crunching on a 4-inch layer of snow. He realized that he had forgotten his gloves, but rather than return to the car and lose minutes of the ebbing daylight, he jammed his hands deeper in his pockets. After a quarter of a mile, he reached a belt of hickory trees and low shrubs. He picked his way around the frozen branches, which sprouted strange growths of ice crystals, and came to a high embankment. The slopes were steep, and he had to use his hands to claw his way up the wind-glazed, slippery surface to the top. At last, his fingers frozen numb, he stood on the long, abandoned trackbed. It was badly eroded in places and covered by tangles of dead and ice-stiffened weeds protruding from the snow. The once busy railroad was only a distant memory. In the dimming light, Pitt's eyes picked out the telltale relics of the past. A few rotting cross-ties half-buried in the ground, an occasional rusty spike, scattered rock from the track ballast. The telegraph pole still stood, stretching off into infinity like a line of straggling, battle-weary soldiers. Their weathered crossbeams were still bolted in place. Pitt took his bearings and began trudging along a slight curve that led up the grade to the empty bridge crossing. The air was sharp and tingled his nostrils. His breath formed shapeless mists that quickly vanished. A rabbit darted in front of him and leaped down the embankment. Dusk had deepened to night. He no longer cast a shadow when he stopped and stared down at the icy river 150 feet below. The stone abutment of the Deauville-Hudson Bridge seemed to lead to nowhere. Two solitary piers rose like forlorn sentinels from the water that swirled around their base. There was no sign of the 500-foot truss they had once supported. The bridge had never been rebuilt. The main track was constructed further south to cross over a newer and stronger suspension span. Pitt knelt on his haunches for a long while, trying to visualize that fateful night, almost seeing the red lights on the last coach grow smaller as the train rolled onto the great center truss, hearing the shriek of tortured metal, the great splash in the uncaring river. His reverie was interrupted by another sound, a high-pitched wailing in the distance. He rose to his feet and listened. For a few moments all he could hear was the whisper of the wind. Then it came again from somewhere to the north, echoing and re-echoing off the forbidding cliffs along the Hudson, the naked limbs of the trees, the darkened hills of the valley. It was a train whistle. He saw a faint, swelling yellow glow moving steadily toward him. Soon other sounds touched his ears, a grinding clatter and the hissing of steam. Unseen birds, startled by the sudden noise, flapped into the black sky. Pitt could not bring himself to believe the reality of what he apparently saw. It was impossible for a train to be speeding over the non-existent rails of the forsaken trackbed. He stood unfeeling of the cold, searching for an explanation, his mind refusing to accept his senses. But the scream of the whistle grew louder and the light brighter. For maybe 10 seconds, maybe 20, Pitt stood as frozen as the trees bordering the trackbed. The adrenaline surged through his bloodstream, and the floodgates of fear burst open and swept away all established thoughts of logic. He began to lose reality as fingers of panic tightened around his stomach. The shrill whistle shattered the night again as the horror laid into the curve and pounded up the grade to the missing bridge, the headlamp transfixing him in a blinding glare. Pitt never remembered how long he watched, petrified, at what deep down he knew to be a superstitious apparition. Faintly, the cry of self-preservation broke through, and he looked around for a way to flee. The narrow sides of the abutment dropped off in the blackness. Behind him was the sheer drop to the river. He felt trapped on the brink of a void. The ghostly locomotive was lunging closer with a vengeance, the clang of its bell audible now above the roar of the exhaust. Then suddenly anger replaced the fear in Pitt, an anger that stemmed partly from his own helplessness, partly from his slowness to act. The moment it took him to make a decision seemed a lifetime. Only one practical direction was open to him, and he grabbed it. Like a sprinter off the mark at the starter's gun, he charged down the grade on a collision course with the unknown.